From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I am in the studios of KCRW, a place I haven't been in at least the last couple of years. My guest, making his directorial debut with A Count of Three, is Gerard Carmichael. At least he says that's his name. As we recently found on HBO, his HBO special, there's more to that name than we might have figured out from just hearing him say Gerard Carmichael. I guess it means we have to redo The Carmichael Show.
Oh,
it's a whole new kind of autobiography, don't we?
Well, it's a whole new concept. The old concept's thrown out of the window.
First, I have to say, it's so great to see you, because it's been a while since I've seen you.
It's been forever.
But to see the special, the HBO special, I guess I forgot is how much your stand-up is like you and it's not like you.
Mm.
I mean, because the excitable part of you, you usually don't display on stage that much, because it's about sort of controlling the audience. But that thing of you as being thoughtful, there's no hesitance when you do it on stage. Whereas in real life, I can see you like looking for a thought.
Yeah.
And that fascinated me to watch the way you use silence on stage, because I forgot about how much you do that.
Yeah. Well, this one was me. This special is the first time it's actually me and combining who I am as a person and who I am as a performer into one being. Like, this is the first time I've ever done that, because I was on stage always trying to have control, and like that was my relationship with the audience, was like this fight for power and control. And I think I had a lot of like anger toward audiences, and like
that pause was often as much out of anxiety as anything else. You were doing something with your hands when you were on stage before the special that I noticed you weren't doing as much here.
Yeah, I don't fidget or anything. Like, I'm just myself now. Like, comics will do, not to call out all their secrets, but like a little nervous mic flex that Bill Burr does, or you know, some rip off Chappelle and slap the mic or do whatever, like little thing. And everyone has their tricks. I'm sure I have my own. I definitely have my own. But you know, they kind of all stem from how I move, and my movement's uninhibited now. I told a friend that since coming out, I take better pictures because I'm not concerned with looking gay. You know, I was afraid of the performance of my masculinity being off or not being true. I don't know what I was doing, but now my movements are more me and it's more fluid and who I am. I'm a little bit sillier than I'd been on stage before. Like, I do like kind of like imitate my family or like do voices and faces and things like that with my friends all the time. But on stage, I was so, you know, serious. It was always like, that's what Eight was. Eight was like a, you know, almost like a speech in like Philadelphia, you know, founding of the country or something.
Or the movie Philadelphia. Would you say serious?
Yeah.
Because I always thought it was being intense, because there's this kind of concentration. In the special, the pauses are sometimes about hesitance about what you're going to say next, rather than using it as a way to sort of work the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying how forgive me for using this term and phrase, out you are as a person in the special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's definitely the marriage of myself to my work. The special is like, I recognize myself in my work. I didn't fully do that before. And a last change, I used to hate it when friends came to see me perform, you know, and I think it's because it was so much a character. It seemed like me, but it felt like false enough that I didn't feel comfortable having people that actually knew me in the room. And that's changed now. Like, you know, I'm still very picky about who's like backstage, but like, you know, in the audience, I don't care.
Not knowing that well, but the assumption I made about seeing you on stage is that, and you were just alluding to that, that stand-ups have persona.
Oh yeah.
And often that person who goes on stage is wildly different than the person who we know stand-ups off stage. So I just thought, well, that's his stage thing, which is really interesting because it feels guarded.
Oh, stand-ups like rap in many ways. It's funny because like rap is all about being real, but they all use fake names
and fake beings.
Yeah, I mean,
like, Cube is nothing like that. I mean,
but it's like, that's not even your name. You're the realest person. Like, you know, like, of course, like all rappers are like Sasha Fierce. You know,
nobody's
what I mean?
A junior on stage.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's also very masculine, like rap.
again, not knowing that well, but knowing you a bit, just and having had seen you before I got to know you, oh, that's just his stage persona. I didn't realize how much that was, that you were actually willfully building walls around this divide between not wanting to show behaviors you thought might give something away that you didn't want to give away. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes me think of what that first scene is like on The Count of Three, which is we think we know, but we don't.
Yeah. 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 It's a complete reversal of everything that you've seen. And that's been a theme in my life. Like, just like, oh, well, what's underneath this? Like, what's behind? And the thought behind starting Count of Three like that is, well, you know, it's exciting and alluring and, you know, a little confusing, but it begs so many more questions. Like, that's my favorite.
But it's also as much too about the kind of thing we would not expect to see in an indie film. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but that countenance that we see, that sort of challenge that the movie starts off with, is like, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah.
This is an indie movie. I can only imagine people seeing a Sundance are going, wait a second.
It's an indie film with, you know, big film aspirations. It probably describes a lot of my work, you know, these really specific, almost niche things that I'm trying to make a grand swing to the, like, a big audience for, right? And because I feel like Count of Three is super indie.
There's a certain kind of archetypal expectation people have of Black behavior in film. Mm. Even in indie film, there's just something we expect to see. So you're playing with that idea too here.
Yeah, well, always, you know, the expectation of Black people is something that I've experienced my whole life for good reasons. I think, you know, Black people have had to present certain aspects of culture to society and have had to be mindful of and guarded about how we're presented. But I think it's sometimes taken too far in art, and it becomes protective of interest and character, and it keeps out, I think, the complications that make art great, that make it interesting. You know, like it's, you know, trying to portray, I guess, aspirational characters, like these characters that can represent and take on. And I've learned in my work that the more specific I am, one, I accept I am Black, right? So my thoughts, and I'm from a very specific Black experience that's, you know, not unique, but it is very specific, just like Southern Christian, lower class, you know, upbringing. It's not about trying to be representative. It's trying to be specific, like my thoughts, my thing, my emotions, what I'm going through, what I can express in stand up or film or television, like, is reflective of a Black culture in an important way because it's specific. It's my experiences, like it's all of the world hitting me and I'm the filter. So like my characters, you know, Val, I think represent so many Black people. So many Black men, my friends, and I just don't see it because I don't think it's, I think it's a little bit dirty laundry. People don't want it to be seen. So I need to show it. Like, that's where I start feeling responsibility in art. Like, I need to show it.
It's the truth. My guess is, I guess we should say AKA Gerard Carmichael, but that's another conversation. He has a brand new film. He directed his directorial debut with Count of Three. And you're saying so many interesting things here, Gerard, because first of all, when you were talking about the real of rap, and so much of Black art is about trying to expose something real, like, while keeping yourself guarded, you know? And you just hit on this kind of fascinating, contradictory dynamic that explains why there's so much, often this sort of undercurrent of anger or anxiety, yeah, because you want to be as real as you can, but how much of yourself do you want to give away?
Yes, yes. And for me, like, Rothaniel, for instance, is like,
By the way, the name is special, Rothaniel.
Yes, yeah, the name is special, Rothaniel. Is me kind of calling the bluff to trying my best to deliver on the promise of truth in art. Like, oh, okay, like, you know, comedy is supposed to be about, oh, we're truth tellers, you know, or we're the guys that tell it like it is and speak the facts that, you know, people are scared to say. It's like, okay, well, here are the things I'm scared to say. Like, how about that for a high wire act? You know, like, these are actually my biggest fears, and I'll do that. Like, how about real stakes? I try and do it with everything, but it's just like, oh, like, are we talking about truth or are we not?
As a performer, as an artist, I think, and somebody who's really aware of image, the way image has been portrayed in so much of Black culture, why do you think there's this fascinating and specific kind of division in Black culture where so much of it is about trying to portray honesty while keeping the most vulnerable or the other side of yourself hidden? It's almost like the idea of being a superhero or going, not that, but comic books where there's an alter ego and the person you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, you do it in the name of protection, right? I can't show this vulnerability because I appear weak, right? That's the thought process. That's what, you know, people try and protect. And you do wild things to protect it. And the chasm grows deeper because you become more focused on protecting the truth than living it and being it. You end up doing wild things like slapping Chris Rock on stage at the Oscars.
we both know Chris. And, you know, it's this sort of thing where you think about what Will Smith has been for 40 years.
Yeah.
And how much of himself he's probably kept hidden.
Yeah.
And I was going to try to make this a place where Black people didn't talk about that.
Oh, my bad. First time in studio, too.
But it's actually, there couldn't be a better time to talk about it than now because...
And I very publicly said I didn't want to talk about it, and now I'm like, no.
But so much of this, too, is about, there's an aspect of a Black culture in terms of the way it's treated that's always reductive. So that slap is about this or this.
Yeah.
And all the complications we're talking about, which is the part of yourself you hide, how much of Will Smith he thought was hiding in plain view, but the fact is this thing comes out, and then it's all about, too, the layers of how much of Chris does he want to show? Because we both know him well enough to know that he could have basically turned that whole evening into like an hour of going after him and not doing that. I mean, there were so many dynamics that are all what you're talking about here and what you decided to do with your life in the last year. This idea, again, the difference between being truthful, quote unquote, or being honest.
Yes, yes. It's easy to perform that too. It's easy to perform truth. I think it's more popular too now. You know, you look at art and the line is getting blurred more and more. Yeah, the chasm between truth and the performance of truth just grows without you knowing it.
Between these two things, between the HBO special and the movie, it feels like that distance that you had is like kind of an ironic distance between your life on stage and who you are. You decide to sort of close that distance. I mean, if we look at Rothaniel, the way it starts, I mean, the snowy streets of Manhattan, and then you come into the club and it's kind of like, it's lighted like Lenny, you know? I mean, the throw of the stage lights and almost black and white of it. And then you hit the stage and this really colorful shirt that brings to mind for me, Richard Pryor in Live on a Sunset Strip or Live in Concert. The idea of like saying, I'm on stage, but I'm not hiding being on stage. I'm not going to try to dress down.
This is a performance.
This is a performance. Yes. And I'm going to dress like I want to be seen.
Yes.
All that calculation about our perception of what performance is all become part of this show, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's my life has become a blur in many ways of when I'm in therapy, I'm like, why am I writing stuff down? You know what I mean? Like, you know, is this for my own like personal growth and epiphany? And I've kind of tied my work to that, but I'm fascinated with it. I'm saying all that to say that I'm very fascinated with it. Like a lot of what I revealed on stage, I brought cameras to my home, you know, with my family before, with home videos, A Sermon on the Mount, you know, these documentaries I made for HBO, because sometimes the cameras help me have a reason to tell the truth. The same way, that's what I say about therapy. Therapy is an excuse to tell the truth. I do like psychoanalysis and it's double sessions twice a week. I don't mean this in any like pretentious way, but it felt like the thinking man's therapy, right? Like just kind of seeking answers, family tree stuff, like digging, understanding. It's free associative. You know, you start, you talk about one thing, you go on tangents. At the end, you realize you've been talking about the same thing the whole time. I should say I. It's an old habit I'm trying to get rid of saying you when I mean I.
My friend, you're talking about America. The you he's talking about is himself. I guess his name is Gerard Carmichael. We're talking about a few things he's done, including his new film, On the Count of Three. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Hey, Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. The shortest break in history. He can't even swallow yet. It's the treatment. My guest is drunk. I should have hit the cough button. My guest is Gerard Carmichael. He's got a wealth of fascinating new stuff happening at this point. His recent special with Daniel is HBO, and the new movie is On the Count of Three. Thinking about the movie, there's so much too about the way you're holding silences in that. Mm-hmm. And I know, as well as anybody who does what you do, you understand the power of silence. But using it as an actor, especially given the kinds of stuff you've done in movies before this, what was it like to be able to control that as compared to having somebody else control the silence for you?
That's a great question. And I never really thought of it as controlling the silence, I guess the same way like with stand-up. Like, I never thought of it from that perspective. I guess I do think of things musically. So everything has a rhythm, everything has a heartbeat.
Including silence has a count too.
Yes, silence absolutely has. There's a limit, you know, like there's a max, and you know, and it does different things, and it goes through different shades, you know. And yeah, I think it's just a default tone that I'm obsessed with. That tone that allows for thinking, you know, just being lost in thoughts and thoughts that are interrupted and broken. And Count of Three, a lot of the inspiration for it was daytime television. It's like having the TV on in the day, and it's like music that's melancholic but optimistic. I like that pocket of like this kind of hazy dream of just like an IHOP at noon on a Monday.
The way the movie unfolds, it feels like it's episodic, but in fact, if you look at it again, you can see how the structure of it.
Yes.
You can see what it's supposed to be.
Yes.
It's almost built like watching TV, where you get stuff in terms of 6 or 7 minutes rather than act one, act two, act three,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
I really liked about it.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. Playing with your sense of time, especially in a film that happens over the course of a day.
We should say it's two characters, Val and Kevin, who have come to a particular sort of wall in their lives.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and we can say they've decided to have one last day on Earth together. We can say that's no spoiler. Talk about truth in art and like how Count of Three like played out. We were talking earlier on in the process about what that would be and what catharsis would mean in that day, and like what loose ends you want to tie up, and what are the things that are the more realistic, because we've seen it done in the big bucket list kind of grand, and we're skydiving, and you know, like, and there are actually aspects of that, but you know, but there is a much more, I think, truthful, messy, sometimes violent reality to what a bucket list would actually be in a truncated period. And so, yeah, like the movie plays with the ambitions of that day and the time of, yeah. Yeah, yeah, a lot.
I don't want to use the word tidy, but there's a deliberation to the structure. I thought I could see your mind in that, because even when with Nathaniel, where it feels like, wow, a series of bombs being set, I was like, yeah, but he knows where all these mines are. He's actually setting them off to get audience reaction. And in the middle of a confession, you drop a joke just so people, wait, what? That's funny.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm very thankful. I have an odd relationship with structure. Bo says I have a natural...
Your director, Bo Burnham, who directed the special, and by the way.
Yeah, yeah, he directed Rothang and directed my whole life. but he says I have like kind of a natural knack for structure. I don't realize what I'm doing sometimes as I'm doing it. I don't realize the structure of it. That device of bringing it up and not bringing it up to the end is just a thing that... Because I was starting to do stand-up again. I texted Kevin Hart and asked if I could just do a spot on his show. He was doing a show at Flappers. And I just opened up for him. And I was just, I did that night, you know, like just like, oh, let's try this. And like, just kind of, I could see it in my head and like throwing the ball in the air and where you catch it. And a lot of the act itself, the lot of the structure of Rothaniel, like so like last minute, like, and Bo even helped me realize things that were there that I didn't realize. Like, I was telling these just felt like important things for me to say. Like, when I started working on the special, Rothaniel, like, was, I need to say this, I need to say this, I need to say this. I didn't realize I was putting up beams to a house. Like, I'm just saying that, I'm like, well, it needs this, or you just kind of feel
it. So you're
it.
An accidental architect is what you're saying.
Kind of, in a way, like, you know, I was talking to my friend Tyler, the creator, about, he designs clothes, and he's an incredible designer, you know, of all things, right? And he's a composer of music, right? And he doesn't know the technical terms of any of these things. Like, he's designing clothes. He doesn't know why, you know, primary colors and pastels clash. He just feels it and he knows it, you know? And then someone who, like, went to school for it says, like, oh, can explain it, you know, like, can explain it, you know? But I just operate a lot of times off feeling. So it's, like, an emotional component to the way I think things that I work with get structured.
The structure that you create tends to be the kind of thing where people don't know where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so is it sort of instinctive that you, like, basically put somebody in a room, but then, like, throw a shaft of light at them so that they don't know where they are in the room until you walk them to the door? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, a little. Yeah, because I like the structure of, like, my old act would be like it's always like a strong first line. Like, first line, shaft of light, now you have to follow me to the source. Exactly. I'm into that. It's the start of Count of Three. Like, all right, boom. Because I'm also playing off of my own attention span. You know, like okay, what would keep my attention?
So often, though, I mean, there was this kind of frame of quote-unquote truth, being ironic about the word truthful here, in your act. I mean, you sort of posit something as if, well, that's what this is. I'm going to tell you the truth about it.
Mm-hmm. It was everybody else's truth in the act before. It was like, I was trying to get to truth and to the bottom of things, whatever, and say the things. Again, say the things you're scared to say. And what I'm mocking it, I'm saying it like that because these have become just like cliches of saying of like, you know, I say to, you know, I get out there every night and I tell the truth kind of thing. I was like, bro, the truth? Oh, the truth? The truth makes me cry. You want me to tell that? That's the truth.
So I haven't seen you in about 4 years. And I wonder what it was like for you in this past couple of years, your relationship to what you thought was honesty. Because being forced to be away from that thing that you can play, and you can play an audience because I've seen you do it. And you're even doing it leading us to the truth at the end of Rothaniel, and on the count of three, you're still playing the audience. So I know where your skill level is. I know what your instincts are for doing that. Without having that thing to answer to and to move and to prod, how much do you think this need for honesty and truth that came out of having been left to your own devices and being left to yourself, how much came out of that?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't.
Because I've seen you, we go, let's go to the comedy store and I'll just do a bit.
Yeah.
And you like go and work this thing out, then we go eat.
Yeah.
And not having that, which gives you a chance to sort of like play with language, which you like to do, and see how people react to just hearing a word spoken.
Yes.
What that does to the room.
Yes.
What that does to the temperature of the room.
Yes.
Not having any of those things.
Mm.
Obviously, there was a question that you had to answer about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, coming out was huge, right? Like, coming out is like a huge thing because I wasn't being my full self, you know, in life. And so art can be an escape, but like, you know, it was even more of a character on stage than, you know, in life, you know. And so everything's changed. And since we've last spoken, like, once I've been made aware of the truth, and what I mean by that is once I've known who I was, once I've known I was gay, when I confronted that, faced it, stopped lying to myself, accepted it, presented it, right? And then the funny thing I found is like once you tell the truth, like it just highlights how much everything else is a lie. And everything else starts feeling so like false, and the bottom falls out. And then it becomes hard to like now, like when you saw me on stage before, like I wouldn't be able to perform the same way because I love words and I love craft, the craft of stand-up. Like, I love the relationship with the performer and the audience. And I rely on certain things. I just can't let them be tricks. They can't be tricks. Like, there are certain things that are natural extensions of my personality, but they can't inhibit the truth. Like, and once I start, it's like telling jokes in therapy. When I'm in therapy, sometimes if I'm like being too funny, I'm just like, oh, wait, I'm getting too far.
So you can even use the therapy session as a way to sort of not deal with yourself by going to the skills that you know that can get you.
To avoid. And that's what I was saying earlier about like therapy. It, for me, is like this time period, I can't lie, right? Because it'd be stupid to lie to your therapist, one, because you're paying for it. Like, just for me to take 3 hours out of my week to like lie to someone is just an egregious waste of time. So why? I don't do that. So I have to be truthful, like, and truthful in a way that, like, you know, all the things I'm afraid of. And I just brought that to art. Yeah, I just brought that to my work. All the things I'm afraid of, like, it's the only thing that felt urgent. You know, like, I wouldn't be able to say those jokes before because they just don't feel urgent to me anymore. Yeah, I can't really say things right now. Maybe it'll change, but that don't feel urgent.
I know you've talked before about directing, and you certainly talked to directors about working with them, but it even feels like getting this movie at this time kind of fell into this mosaic of this life that you're now building for yourself, or the idea of being honest, and these are characters who are trying to be honest with themselves.
Mm.
And it's hard to do that when the world feels oppressive to you.
I'm glad the movie's coming out now, because I feel that this movie speaks to the malaise of the current moment in a way that I haven't seen many things speak to. Because a lot of times the art, the films, television, music that stems from the current moment are in many ways escapism, you know, and those are the things that, you know, are created, and there's war on Earth, so we go to space and whatever, and then we reflect the war later. But like, and now it's becoming protest work, which is still a version of performance.
But it's the difference between, again, being truthful and being honest.
Yeah.
Because that performance you're talking about is kind of on a mission, but it's not actually sort of dealing with the person who's launched the mission.
Well, I felt in many ways that the truth of the character Val was my own, in that I felt like that cloud, that like lack of motivation, you know, for a while. And it felt like we weren't sharing it. Like, it's just like I felt, you know, directionless. And then I, like, all my friends were speaking in these, you know, living your truth and best life kind of terms. And, like, you know, like, and, like, you go to Instagram and I'm like, oh, so y'all are happy? Oh, so everybody's happy. Oh, okay.
They're happy in those pictures.
Yeah, everyone seems so happy. And then that made me sadder.
We're probably out of time, so I will want to thank AKA Gerard Carmichael. You probably know him as Rathaniel, but his HBO special is Rathaniel. And his movie, his new film, his directorial debut is On the Count of Three. Gerard Carmichael, I can't thank you enough. It's so good to see you.
This was really fun. Thank you. Good to see you.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. For those of you sticking around for the next segment, my guest is writer, actor, and now revealed as singer Paula Pell, outing her inner vocalist on Girls 5 Eva, the comedy series on Peacock. If not, you can hear that interview and past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And The Treatment can be heard wherever you get your podcasts. Stay tuned and keep listening to The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is a terrifically talented writer, and as we're learning in the past decade or so, an equally talented actor. We know her for about almost 20 years, my gosh, of writing for SNL, creating characters such as the Culps and the Cheerleaders. And you may have seen her in Wine Country. And one of my favorite things, I should say before we go any further, was the character she played in the original cast album Co-op on Documentary Now, a great performance. And she's proving to be equally adept in the new series in its second season now on Peacock, Girls 5 Eva. I'm talking to Paula Pell. Hi, Paula.
Hi. Hi, were you talking about me? I am so sorry. I thought it was someone else. I was like, who is that? I'd love to meet them.
Well, gosh, but there's so much to talk to you about. And I guess my first question is, because your character, Gloria, on Girls Forever is so confident as a singer. Did you grow up singing?
I grew up singing. I was always a musical theater nerd, and I was a choral nerd. I was always in chorus, you know, even through college, concert choirs and competitive choirs and show choirs. I loved harmonizing. I come from a family that always harmonizes, and we'd always break into Christmas songs and harmonize. And my mama and dad have a great ear for throwing in harmonies, and I got that from them. So yeah, I always loved singing. I, of course, really do think of myself as like a B-minus, C-plus singer, but I'm faking it with this group in Girls 5 Eva. I'm just trying to stay as under the radar as I can in my alto line and just kind of not being noticed in any negatives, just being just good enough to keep the job.
With the Culps or the Cheerleaders or even playing Patty in original cast album and now Gloria here, this kind of through line, these characters who kind of have an addiction to performing or this need to perform and are wrestling with it.
I was always performing. I was always doing theater when I was young and just, you know, in my little Catholic school. And we had amazing plays in our little Catholic schools. I look back on them now and even hear recordings or watch old antique video of reel-to-reel, whatever, Super 8s of these plays that were so, so well put together. And I was grateful for having that upbringing because I got the hunger for it. And I loved it so much. And then when I got SNL as a writer, it was really like, take your performing hat off. They weren't saying it in any sort of abusive way or mean way of like, you know, stop being a performer, but they were saying this job is not just a stepping stone for you to become a cast member here. This is truly, we want you to write for these cast members, you know, to be a true writer here. And so, you know, I did that and I put it away for so long. And, you know, in my personal life, I had a piano at home and I would still sing with friends sometimes. But it was many years before I ever allowed myself to perform again. So when I came back and started performing, it was just like the joy of it. You know, I always said that like being a writer is like being the parent and being the actor is like being the child in a lot of ways, in the fact that you're out there playing and being able to do these amazingly fun sort of expressive, you know, things. And writers are more worriers. You know, we're always like insecure, low self-esteem. And not that actors can't have low self-esteem, because I know a lot of us do, but it's just such a inward worried sort of, we have to deal with any problems and crises. And so once I started performing again and in this show particularly got all these crazy good scripts to perform, I'm like, I don't have to do jack. I can just enjoy it and, you know, really, truly be an actor and just like be a child.
Well, it's funny you say that and talking about joy, because one of my favorite moments is a moment in the pilot where after a Girls 5 Eva hit the stage again after a lengthy hiatus, and Gloria is kind of sifting through all these emotions, trying to figure out what she's undergoing. She finally, oh, it's joy. And I just love that moment because you just play it so real.
My therapist told me this really, I have a wonderful therapist I've been going to for 97 years. And she's Karen. Hi, Karen. She's incredible. And she said to me one time that blew my mind. She said, adults are not comfortable with the idea of being excited. They call it stress. So when you hear the language of when people say like, I just got a new job and I'm just so stressed out. I'm so stressed out. I'm so nervous. I'm so stressed. And it's like, are you excited? And you just don't call it that anymore because adults don't really embrace that they're like excited. Like when you're young and you have a new class you're going to take that you're excited about, or I got new art supplies, or I got a new bike, or like I'm excited. But whenever adults talk about stuff like that, it's like, you know, we bought a new house and it's like, great, that's amazing, right? And they're like, well, I mean, it's amazing, but it's a lot, you know, and so I feel like Gloria is always trying to find like what she should be worried about. I just read something that equally blew my mind this week that said worrying is praying for what you don't want. And I thought that was such a good quote because it is that meditation on the negative of like, I'm worrying about all the things, all the ways this is going to be a disaster. It's a meditative prayer, really, and giving it all this attention. So, you know, you don't want to give it attention.
My guest who's closing in on 100 years of therapy is Paula Pell. She stars as Gloria in Girls 5 Ever on Peacock. But what I wanted to say, too, about that beat, I mean, it could be played as a kind of a sitcom moment or a broad sketch moment, but we could actually see Gloria just kind of almost going through these files in her head. And I thought that was such a terrific moment that gave me so much happiness. I thought, you really found a ground floor for this character. I know who that person is.
Oh, I'm so glad that resonated, because I think the thing that always broke my heart about Gloria from the beginning is similar to my history, is that, you know, I was closeted pretty late. I was closeted up until quite a few of my years at SNL. So I was in my 30s without ever feeling open to, you know, I even was in a relationship for a long time and still closeted, you know, with my first girlfriend who became my wife, my first wife. So I love the tie-in to her having finally broken through to realize that, like, we're just gonna push through and actually admit what we want. And we're gonna admit that we want something. And, you know, God forbid you want something that's passionate and exciting. And like, you're so fearful that you're gonna get judged and with our age and everything. And then we do it and it's exhilarating. And you realize nobody really cares. Like, they're not gonna stop you doing it. It's up to you to do it. And so the joy had so many layers. It was so fun to do that scene talking about, last time I felt this, the girl brought a fat kitten to our kindergarten class. It's like, she's remembering the last time she was truly free was in a kindergarten playing with a little kitten.
We should say the show is about a girl group that experienced a one hit in the 90s and now had a chance to resuscitate its career. And Gloria has made this decision to just be a grown-up, to be an adult. We get to see her wrestling with her life constantly. And I love the way you play that, because all the things that she probably would not have said out loud before, she now says out loud all the time.
Yes.
And
yes,
we can almost see these thoughts being these tangible things in front of her. And it's interesting to see how much of this you're actually saying dovetails with parts of your own life.
Yeah. My mother is in her mid-80s, 84, and she is so unfiltered now that it's glorious. It's just glorious to listen to my mother just watch a television show and look at someone's hair and say, I wouldn't go out and take a in the yard with that hairdo. Like, just the most hilarious. Both my parents and my sister and I, we're of an age now where it's just like, you just say it. Like, you just, you know, I was saying to somebody the other day, anytime I get on a plane, if somebody is like stinking up the joint, like nothing worse than when someone's like sitting near you that's like passing gas. I used to sit there and just be furious deeply inside. And now I just go, oh my God. Oh my God. And I'm just like, really, I can't hold it in. I can't hold in anything. You know, I'm still a kind person. I still try to have some grace and some class. But I've just grown out of editing, deep editing. We all carry around so many filters and edits of what we should say or not say right now or whatever. And now if it's something that I feel like Gloria really, you see in the second season even more with her friendships and with her desire to just make this work. It's like, this is a chance we have to really have joy all the time. Let's try to make it work.
These characters you created on SNL, like, again, like the Spartan cheerleaders or the Culps, or even seeing it to some extent in Patty and original cast album Co-op on Documentary now seeing it revisited in Gloria, this thing where this need to perform never goes away and how you wrestle with it and having to recognize it. It's a fascinating thing to see played out in your career in so many ways.
When I was at SNL, I would have like we know a lot of times the people that only have like one line in the monologue are usually writers. And so you'll just be like, oh, that's one of the writers. And you kind of get to know them where you're like, oh, that must be a writer because they're always on here sitting in the audience. So I would do that occasionally. And because all I had ever done until I went there, I was a performer. And so acting, I mean, I used to do like, you know, tour a one woman show, do Belle of Amherst and, you know, tour through Tennessee. And like, it was like an hour and a half show where I was only on stage alone. And I would go on there live in that show to say a four word sentence. And I would be absolutely shitting my dress. Like I would soil my dress in nerves of saying four words. And I remember thinking, oh God, I've lost it. I've lost my courage. I've lost my ability to just be in my body and perform. And it's so natural to me and I've lost it. And once I started doing it again in longer versions with, you know, doing 30 Rock or doing Parks and Rec, or I would, you know, the more I started creating my own stuff that I could perform, I remembered very quickly that it's not something that can just go away. And I had such a love and thirst for it. By the time I started doing it again, I was, you know, and I really enjoyed writing. I really enjoyed becoming a writer, and truly that show made me a writer, but man, I missed it. And you know what's funny is when I think back on it, anyone would say like, did you used to sit there as a writer and really miss performing? And the main time I did is when I would write a musical sketch. So if I wrote a sketch where everyone was singing and harmonizing and learning their parts, and I would sit there, you know, in the studio watching with my script and be like, how did I end up on this side of it? Like, how did I end up not doing that part? And now I can't believe that that's like the main thing I'm doing at this age. It really teaches you a lesson that you never know. You never know.
It's true, but it's also that these characters that you've written so often on the show, and now you're going to deliver this life, this thing that once you've done it, is this current that runs through your life. And I would just find myself fascinated and sort of thinking about this, how often that's been the kind of the subtextual thing in your work.
My parents have a reel-to-reel recording at some place in a dusty corner of a closet where I am 3 years old singing Animal Crackers in My Soup. And I keep saying beer instead of soup. And I'm really cracking my ass up. I mean, laughing so belly, like when a 3-year-old laughs, like belly laugh at themselves, you know, because I keep hesitating at soup and then going beer. And then I laugh really hard. And I'm like, oh boy, someone was really amused at herself very early in life. It's just been the trajectory of my life.
I was just thinking about the willfulness, the determination of Patty. I keep going back to Co-op because it's such a great performance and such a great
loved
piece.
I loved doing that so much. We wanted that to be a real show. We shot it in Portland and we learned everything really fast and we shot it really fast and we finished it and we were like, wait, we don't get to go in a van and go to Cleveland next and perform it there? Like, it really felt like this is a musical that we're workshopping and we have to go to the next place and perform it. And we were kind of heartbroken that we realized this is just a parody of a documentary about, you know, about a Sondheim musical. So it was so fun to do that.
Just having it literally sat on stage with you and watching your concentration, I can sort of see that there's this thing in you, you're not trying to find a way to sort of play the comedy. You're trying to make these characters as real as possible. And we can see Patty's determination to sort of make this thing happen and creating these waves of tension in the execution of all of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like Patty. Patty is just, you know, and of course, it's inspired by the great Elaine Stritch. And in that real documentary about Company is that you just see her sitting there being so vicious with herself because she is not perfection. She knows she's perfection, but she cannot be. She can't get there yet. And she knows that Stephen is looking at her with a little disappointment. She can feel it. And she's just like, I am going to keep trying this. I'm going to keep trying this. And then they say, go home and come back, take a shower, freshen up. And then she comes back and of course, nails the hell out of it. And there have been times when I watched that documentary where I was like, did Elaine know that she eventually was building up to the perfection and nailing it? And she was just taking the ride because it's such a wonderful dramatic ride of like, I can't get it. I can't get it. God damn it. I can't get it. And then suddenly it just comes out like golden ribbons, you know?
You just said something that struck me. You said Belle of Amherst. You mean the Emily Dickinson one-woman show, Belle of Amherst?
Yes. Yes. And you know what's funny is I always said I was born at 50 because I was always the mother superior in Sound of Music. Like when I was a freshman in high school, I was always the 50 to 70 year old character. And I always had gray spray in my hair. And I have endless pictures of me with gray spray in my hair from every play, every musical. I have recording of me doing Mother Superior going, Maria, you shall lead forth with peace. And I sound like a 58-year-old woman that lives in a convent, and I'm 13. I'm like barely had my period, and I'm talking like the most matron on earth. The funny thing now is it is exactly what I kind of suspected when I was younger and I stopped acting, was like, oh, I'll age into it maybe at some point. I'll age into it. And it's exactly what I did, is once my hair started going gray and once I just started looking older, then I started acting more. I started looking like all these characters I would play before and wear a bunch of age makeup.
Clearly, there's such a strain of this de facto autobiography in your career, how well you knew Meredith Scardino, the creator of the show, before she got you the script.
I didn't know Meredith, but I had such a parallel life with her, knowing her because, you know, I'm very, very close with Tina of many, many years. And so
that's Tina Fey. Tina would one of the greatest,
Tina
one of
Fey,
the
yes.
Of the show.
Tina came a couple of years after me to SNL and was, you know, a young, brilliant writer and performer. And now, of course, you know, she runs the world. And when she would always talk about Meredith, it was just glowing because she loved Meredith's humor. She loved her ability to write jokes. She was like, Paula, Meredith is the deal. She is so good. She's so funny. She's so great. And she's a nice person and she's brilliant. And she would always talk her up to me. And we would never really meet. We just never had times we were working together. So we barely, barely ever met. And then a year before we did this show, I had dinner with Tina out in LA with Meredith because they were out there pitching the show. And they were telling me about it. And I think at that time they said something about there's a part that could be really funny for you. And then it just was never talked about again. So I kind of forgot about it. But I have to say, because she came up so much through Little Stranger and with Tina and Robert and Jeff and Eric, like she came up through that pedigree of comedy writing, that I immediately got her and she got me, because they attract certain people that have a certain kind of brilliance in their joke writing. And it was really great to recognize that skill in her and have total trust.
This thing, too, that I think kind of connects Meredith to what they do at Tina's company, is that sort of intersection of real and the absurd.
Yes. And this show in particular, I think, has such a great balance of heart and hard comedy. I love heart. I love drama. I love to have those little moments in it. But I also know that with a half hour comedy, it's really hard to have things that land emotionally, because you usually cut them out. You're usually like, you know what? We don't need it. It's not going to, we don't have time to earn that. And she is so good at, in this sea of hilarity, having this one little boat thematically of something that we're following through in the episode that like will make us tear up, you know, that's like a real emotional thread with the friendships, with Ashley being, is she dead or not? Like, just all their joy of starting to try to be a better person, to find love, all those themes, they're really emotional. But then they're surrounded with this bouquet of hard jokes, of hard, hard lines, like that are really many a page.
No, but this thing too is kind of built in the framing around it, which is a thing I think creates this interesting tension and kind of a drama too, is just the ruthlessness of pop as an idiom, and what does it take? What does it ask of you?
Yeah. And also with, you know, with women in particular, it's like in acting, and I mean it is getting better because creators are writing for older women now in amazing, amazing characters, but
with music, sometimes you'd look and you go like, where did so-and-so go? Like, where? Wait, I don't even know any of these people. I had a funny thing recently where I was cleaning my house or something, and I looked on Spotify and tried to find a lesbian mix. I want a lesbian music mix. And I went, and it was like lesbian music mix, you know, top lesby songs, like just some fun mix. And I looked at it and I didn't know any of them. I didn't know any of the songs. And I was like, I'm not that old. Jesus, like, who are all these people? And what are these songs? Like, are there just generations of gay women that have now surpassed me? And I don't even know any of these. So I had to like start using adjectives added to the search, like antique lesbian songs, vintage, deeply ancient lesbian, tired old dusty lesbian songs, you know, and then I started recognizing the songs. But yeah, pop music is tough. And of course, just like acting, it's like they celebrate the shiny newest thing. So it's kind of wonderful to have so much heart in it where you really root for them. Because I think Meredith doesn't want them to be hugely or immediately successful. We have bursts of it where it's like, oh my God, we got a record deal. Oh, it's with the Property Brothers. Okay, well, that's okay. We're going to still do a good record, you know? So it's always like the struggle in the middle. It's not anything that's immediately shooting to the top, which I love.
Paula, thank you so much. My guest is Paula Pell. Of course, her newest triumph as an actor is Girls 5 Eva on Peacock.
Thanks, Elvis.
Look at me, Cinderella, stroke of midnight, footman gone.
You're listening to The Treatment, and next, it's The Treat with the artist who brought bad taste to center stage, writer, director, and now novelist John Waters, on the movie that planted the seed of his sensibility.
Broken, unenchanted, someone else's sheets are soiled. Linen she picked up at Bloomie's for a marriage that I spoiled. I gotta go. I gotta hail a pumpkin coach. And I gotta go. This ain't my room, my man approach.
Hello, this is John Waters, and this is The Treat. When I was a kid, I had to go to Sunday school because my mother was Catholic, my father wasn't, but they didn't send me to Catholic school, so that was the worst thing. You had to go once a week to Sunday school where these evil nuns who really hated you and your parents because you didn't go to Catholic school would brainwash you. And the main thing they did was read us movies that we would go to hell if we saw. I was 8 years old. There was no way I could see these condemned movies, but I remembered every name. And the one they talked the most, how much they hated, was called Mom and Dad.
Look, Sarah, why don't you sit down and have a heart-to-heart talk with the girl, like a mother should. After all, she's not a baby any longer.
Talk to her. Talk to her. That's all I've done for years. What more is there to talk about?
You might talk about everything. How girls get into trouble. A lot of them have babies and all that sort of thing.
Why, Dan Blake, how can you suggest such a thing? Joan is a sweet, innocent girl, and I'm not going to fill her clean mind with a lot of worldly knowledge.
Mom and Dad was a sex education movie that came out in the 50s that made a fortune. And Kroger Babb was the director, promoter, producer, sleaze king, the first one ever. And he went from city to city and would show this movie. And the secret was they showed the actual birth of a baby, the medical footage, which weirdly was the only way that men could see frontal nudity on the screen in the 50s. They had to watch birth.
The pictures we are now viewing are of a normal birth. You will note that the baby's head delivers itself first, as nature intended. Now you see how a baby comes into the world.
So I snuck downtown and saw this, and I saw men arousing and pleasuring themselves watching birth. And I think that is why I'm damaged for the rest of my life.
I just wish it had never happened.
So do I, but
Well, it was just one of those things, that's all. Don't feel badly about it, Joan.
But I feel like a leper, unclean and ashamed to associate with my friends. I can't even look my mother and dad in the eye.
So they had fake nurses in the theater that sold sex education literature. They had ambulances outside for shocked patrons that were taken away. So this gave me such a jolt as a child. And I had heard about William Castle, so I knew about showmanship and I knew about gimmicks and everything. But this, to me, was so impressive and so bizarre that I tried to follow in the footsteps only with humor, is to be a showman and to make a new kind of exploitation film, which was for art theaters, where I just took everything from underground movies and foreign films that were breaking all the censored taboos and exploitation films, which we always had in Baltimore, to put it together.
Where shall we dream tonight? Let's watch our hearts take flight and find a secret rendezvous.
And I still have the poster from it. I have Mom and Dad cream that they sold, Mom and Dad playing cards. They had branding before anything of this movie that was just a fake movie about birth control and about teen pregnancy. But the real key was they showed the actual birth of a baby as exploitation, which to this day is the most tasteless thing I've ever heard in show business. So Kroger Babb, I salute you. I even found the person that lived in his house, and they sent me his Christmas card with Kroger Babb and his wife Mildred, which I used as a party invitation. So it has been an inspiration, and I thank you, Kroger Babb.
You call me up and make a date for 20 of two. You make me wait and wait and wait, yes, that's what you do. You make me for one little kiss, but leave it to you.
That was director, writer, actor, and now novelist John Waters, whose book is Lawyer Mouth, A Feel Bad Romance. The treatment is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. The show is mixed by Katie Gilchrist. I'm pointing at her right now. We had help from Laura Kandarajan. And next up, there's music from Ann Litt. It's going to make your weekend better, I promise you. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.